Hello, and welcome to my podcast. Today's episode is from the archives. This video was originally published on June 15th, 2020. Being originally made for YouTube, there may be occasional references to visual materials. To listen ad-free, consider becoming a patron at patreon.com/vicedrhino. Please enjoy. Hello, and welcome to my channel. Viced Rhino here. Today I'm looking at a video from what looks like the official Is Genesis History YouTube channel, in which Dr. Marcus Ross, who has legitimate scientific credentials in paleontology, explains what we find in the fossil record. Dr. Ross is one of the interesting characters who seems to be able to maintain the cognitive dissonance of understanding exactly how we know the ages of various fossils, and even publishing research that uses these numbers, while firmly insisting that the Earth is just 10,000 years old at most. I even tracked down the guy's doctoral dissertation, not a hint of creationism to be found. Closest thing to it is a Bible verse quoted in the acknowledgments. He even gives the dates for rock formations and sequences in millions of years. The whole thing is just chock full of real science. Weird. Let's go!
Steve and I saw these nautiloid fossils in the Grand Canyon. How do they fit in that overall fossil record?
Well, for starters, you'd have to be more specific than that. Nautiloid is a term that could refer to any of a number of creatures that span a period of time that is almost half a billion years long.
Well, one of the things I like about natural history museums is they often have dioramas like this, which lay out a whole series of different ecosystems and communities.
And therein lies the rub. You see, it's not just that different organisms are found in different layers, and so we know that it happened over vast periods of time. It's that the entire ecosystems are found in different layers, all with dozens to hundreds of unique organisms all their own, right on top of each other in the fossil record. It's kind of tricky for an entire ecosystem to move in directly on top of the previous ecosystem and then get wiped out, all in the same flood event that wiped out the first ecosystem.
And so what we're seeing with these is the community structure, the community makeup. What are the animals, what are the plants that are found in some of those layers? And in the Grand Canyon, as well as everywhere else, those layers are stacked on one another in order to form the fossil record of the geological column.
Yes, surprisingly accurate description for a creationist. This is why Dr. Ross here is a slippery creationist. He can slide back and forth between scientific explanations and non-scientific creationist conclusions almost seamlessly. It really is quite something.
Okay.
And what the fossil record is really those stacks of layers with the communities in them. And we use the fossils like the post-it notes to figure out where exactly we might happen to be in those layered communities.
See? He's even giving an accurate description of index fossils and how they are used. Now, I'm sorry, I don't mean to break in so frequently here. I'm not used to being able to go this long without there being some serious scientific disagreement with a creationist video.
So the trick is, the real data are these stacks of rocks that have fossils in them. The interpretation is then how those stacks of rocks came to exist, and why is it that some communities of animals in these rocks look the same or different from ones that are below.
And here we go. We are starting to exit the science now. One of the main keywords to listen for when looking out for the switch to pseudoscience is interpretation. It's not that acknowledging that there is interpretation going on is itself pseudoscientific, it's that creationists like to try and make it look like the only difference between mainstream science and creationism is just the interpretation. The data could point to either one just as well. Well, that's just not true. It can only point to creationism if you practice
extreme cherry picking.
These dioramas show us what each of those individual communities would have looked like. And from a creation perspective, what I like about this is it gets us the idea of what if we were transitioning from deeper water communities to progressively more and more shallow communities as we go through, because...
Yeah, no. There were plenty of shallow marine environments in the Cambrian, and there's not some neat transition from deep to shallow to land. I mean, there is a transition to land, but not in the deep oceans were flooding so the land creatures were the last to be killed kind of way. More in a life started in the oceans, and when it finally did make it to land, it happened slowly with a gradual increase in biodiversity, just like what happened with the marine life when it first started. And let's not forget that for each of these systems of layers, we have examples of several different kinds of environments. So there are deep marine ecosystems in the Cambrian, but there are also shallow marine ecosystems in the Cambrian. And while life had not yet diversified to a point where we have complex land-based ecosystems, we do have geologic evidence of dry land existing in Cambrian rock, with the different depositional environments that exist.
One of the big pictures that we have in the fossil record is that the lower units are dominated by marine organisms, by shells, clams, trilobites, things like that.
Yes, because life originated in the water, water-based organisms are the first life to be found in the fossil record. This is entirely unsurprising. What is surprising, though, is that you never find Cambrian organisms in anything other than Cambrian rock layers. Or at least that should be surprising for creationists, because creationism would suggest that they should be found all over the place. Interestingly, you won't find anglerfish in the Cambrian layers either. One of the deepest living organisms that there is, it won't be found in the deepest layers. They don't start to show up until around 100 million years ago in the Cretaceous layers. It's interesting to me that modern deep sea creatures that are known to have a long evolutionary history are not represented in the deepest layers, if the deepest layers were truly the deepest dwelling organisms rather than just the oldest.
The higher that you get up, the more terrestrial organisms start showing up.
Yes, because terrestrial organisms evolved later than marine organisms. But you don't find bunnies or birds when you start finding terrestrial organisms. You find critters like Tiktaalik and Acanthostega, which look not quite fully suited to life on land.
It's as if, you know, all the stuff in the ocean is being destroyed, and then eventually the stuff on land starts getting destroyed too.
Well, no, because we still have evidence of thriving marine ecosystems during the same period that you start to see land animals showing up. There were vast shallow oceans in the Devonian that had rich reef-based ecosystems. We also have the supercontinent Gondwana during this period, which is something I've never heard a creationist addressed. Usually, it's claimed that all the continents were together as Pangaea before the flood, and during the flood they separated to form the continents as we see them today. This has all sorts of issues with breaking the laws of physics, but ignoring that, Pangaea was not the first continent. We have good geologic evidence for the existence of other continental arrangements before Pangaea. Are we supposed to believe that the continents bounced back and forth between being supercontinents and being separated continents several times during the 1 year of the flood? We've got the supercontinents of Ur, Kennerland, Columbia, Rodinia, Pannotia, and Pangaea, all forming, separating, and reforming within a year? And somehow, with this massive geologic upheaval, all of the ecosystems managed to be buried nice and tidily organized by the depth at which they existed? I think not.
And then, you know, sooner or later you get to the end of the flood and other things are going on after the flood, but big picture-wise we have this overall shift from lots and lots of marine organisms to transition to some terrestrial to mostly terrestrial, and then the flood is probably done.
Why would that even be the progression during the flood? Like, sure, it kind of makes sense if you don't think about it too much, but wouldn't marine organisms actually be some of the last ones to be buried in a catastrophic flood? Being already in water, they would have a certain amount of protection from the rain. Sure, some of them might get caught up in mudslides and whatnot, but that would be the exception rather than the norm. And also, with how turbulent the water would have had to have been, how would they even get buried in a layered fashion? Organisms spanning more than one stratigraphic layer would be the norm rather than the exception if layers actually formed during the flood, which is actually quite impossible given what we know about rock formation.
So one of the things that we can see here is that we've got communities. Right here we have the Cambrian community, and that is on this side. If you want to think about the Grand Canyon, take the Grand Canyon, tip it sideways.
Okay.
So you tipped everything sideways. Here's the Great Unconformity.
All right.
Back over here, those are the granites and the non-fossil bearing rocks. The Great Unconformity, and then the first thing that we find is this community.
I don't know about the Grand Canyon specifically, but we do have fossils from before the Cambrian. This is one of those things that was predicted by evolution. Darwin himself was rather flummoxed by the apparent lack of Precambrian fossils, much to the delight of creationists who see any doubt that Darwin might have had as evidence that his theory is not as well supported as it actually is. So if evolution is true, then the further back in time you go, the simpler the organisms should be. Well, the Cambrian organisms are basically a bunch of simplified versions of most of the phyla that exist today, so that tracks. And if we go back to the Precambrian, life was just single-celled bacteria for the vast majority of its existence. For almost 3 billion years, there was no multicellular life. Then, just 600 million years ago, the first multicellular organisms started to appear, and they were very simple. The precursors to sponges, jellyfish, coral, and the like. All of this before the Cambrian. Before the flood, according to you. Why is it that there is no evidence of the dinosaurs and mammals and fish and marine mammals and whatnot that are supposed to have existed then, but there is a plethora of evidence of very simple primitive life forms? This isn't during their time in the Garden of Eden, so there was no death. This is between Eden and the flood. 2,000-some years. According to young Earth creationism, that's about a third of the Earth's history. Not a single fossil of anything more complicated than a sponge for a third of the Earth's history. While things were living and dying, while there were surely local floods and landslides and mudslides and everything else that causes fossils, where are those fossils?
It has been pulled up and deposited and thrust over the continent and deposited right in what's now Arizona.
Uh-huh.
Did you hear yourself just now? It got pulled up and deposited on the continent? So somehow, this one ecosystem got pulled up and shoved onto a huge chunk of land, all without burying a single land animal that lived on this huge chunk of land. I know the whole creationist explanation for why the fossils are sorted the way they are has something to do with those animals' abilities to escape the flood, but really, we see local floods that kill humans every year. Humans are the most intelligent animal on the planet. That's supposed to be why we don't see human fossils until the very, very top. And yet, we sometimes can't escape little tiny regional floods. But somehow, every land animal that lived in the 300,000 square kilometers of Arizona managed to escape before the Cambrian organisms got smushed there. And Arizona has a very rich fossil history, with fossils representing all of the major geologic periods, and all kinds of terrestrial and marine organisms, from massive dinosaurs to tiny fish, and including evidence of organisms going about their normal lives, like dinosaur footprints. Tell me, how does a dinosaur make a footprint that can survive to become a fossil on top of an already flooded out Cambrian ecosystem that the land animals had to evacuate to avoid?
And inside that are things like these predatory critters called Anomalocaris. You've got trilobites. There are sponge-like creatures down over here. There's little echinoderms. There's a functional community there.
Yes, a functional community that got all swept up together without getting any of their members mixed up with all of the other functional community ecosystems that we have fossil evidence for in the same place.
Mm-hmm. As we move closer to the shore, think of that as a bit of a deep water environment. Uh-huh. Moving a little bit closer to the shore, we start getting into a shallow carbonate reef.
Yes, we get to the shallow marine Ordovician ecosystems, which somehow look completely different from the shallow marine ecosystems from any other time period, despite actually existing simultaneously according to creationists.
Okay, and that carbonate reef has got some corals in it. It's got a group of brachiopods. Nautiloids start showing up. Now, they're not the same nautiloids you see in Grand Canyon.
Okay.
But the Grand Canyon does have some other nautiloids. That's the Ordovician group.
Did you notice how you described an ecosystem that is completely unique to those strata? You don't find Cambrian organisms in Ordovician ecosystems, except for the ones that have spent some time evolving, like trilobites. Going back to your explanation as to why we find the deep marine ecosystems of the Cambrian in Arizona, how did the deep marine ecosystem get pulled up and shoved to the continent without any sort of intermingling with the shallow marine ecosystem that would have existed between the deep marine and the continent? Now, I can hear the creationist response to this. There are trilobites in both groups and some others as well. But here's the thing. These groups of organisms that span both ecosystems are not identical. You never find an Ordovician trilobite in Cambrian layers, nor do you ever find a Cambrian trilobite in Ordovician layers. There wouldn't be some neat and tidy divide like that if they actually existed simultaneously. It would have been a random jumble, especially if one had to be swept right past and through the other one in order to get to Arizona.
As we keep moving closer and closer toward shore, we're picking up more and more organisms.
But that's not what you said happened to the Cambrian organisms. You literally said
it has been pulled up and deposited and thrust over the continent.
So which is it? Are these different ecosystems that are geographically separated that somehow ended up getting smashed together one on top of the other once they had fossilized by themselves? Or were they organisms that were swept up over the continent before they were buried? There are several issues with both of these ideas, but it would be nice if you could at least remain consistent.
So again, more sea scorpions in this case start showing up. We end up with more nautiloids, fish of wide and very odd variety.
Were you not supposed to be moving from deep to shallow with this whole thing? Because one of the defining characteristics of the Silurian period was the deepening of the seas, not to mention the stabilizing of the climate, which is a neat trick to pull off during a massive destabilizing global flood. There's also, again, the issue of there being no organisms mixed up with the other groups. In fact, the Silurian stratigraphy is divided into four distinct epochs that can be distinguished from each other by which specific species of graphiolites can be found there. There's also a lot of shale in the Silurian, which is a type of rock that forms in water with a gentle current for deposition. Is there anything about the story of the flood that suggests that gentle currents were involved? And let's not forget, it's not just the Silurian that has shale. Shale makes up some 70% of sedimentary rock on the entire Earth. Its formation would be completely impossible in an event as disruptive as Noah's flood.
And as we come closer still, we keep getting just a little bit closer to shore until eventually, once we get into the Mississippian, which for the Grand Canyon has got the nautiloids, but on the other side of the country, when you're in the Appalachians, this is the coal-bearing units.
Yes. Coal, the result of dense vegetation in swampy climates. And I suppose you're going to explain just exactly how a densely vegetative ecosystem could have time to form on top of the remains of some of the previous ecosystems that you've mentioned here, well in the middle of being flooded out? Also, it bears mentioning here that, well, yes, the flood is supposed to have lasted for about a year, the entire Earth was supposed to have been covered after about 40 days. So all of these ecosystems had 40 days to be swept to wherever the flood swept them, get buried, and for that sediment to lithify to a point where the next layer wouldn't just become part of the previous layer in the conglomerate-style deposit that is indicative of a flood.
Explaining those coal beds is an interesting trick because the plants are not like pines and oaks and things like that that we see. They're very, very odd, different, even somewhat cylindrical and hollow plants.
Yeah, and it's worth mentioning that not only in the coal layers, but in every single geologic period in which plants with root systems existed, we have examples of plants with root systems leaving marks in the layers. Why is that important? Because it shows that plants had time to lay down roots and start growing. If all these rock layers were laid down in one giant flood, there wouldn't be established root systems in the layers. When, in the 40 days that it took for the whole Earth to be covered in water, were plants able to just start growing their roots?
Some creationists think that this might actually represent a forest that was floating out as kind of a subcontinent-sized mat of vegetation to explain the types of plants that we see making up those coal beds.
Well, that's certainly one I haven't heard yet. Though it seems other creationists have. When I searched for floating forest to form coal, the top results were articles from creationist sites, all explaining why this idea is too absurd even for them. Do I really need to address this claim if it's already too crazy for the most prominent creationist organizations? Oh, well, shit. On closer inspection, this AIG article is actually supporting the idea and suggests that the reason plants show up in the fossil record in the exact order predicted by evolution, from simple to complex, is that the smaller, simpler plants would have been at the edge of the mat and would have been ripped off and sunk first in the flood. Oh dear. Well, let's just quote Creation Ministries International at them. Creation scientists should not dogmatically hold to a hypothesis that cannot adequately explain even the smallest subset of coal deposits, let alone the later and thicker coal beds.
So by the time we get to something like the Mississippian, we're right near the shore or on the shore and getting terrestrial environments. We're starting to get terrestrial organisms by the time we're in the Mississippian.
Well, the Mississippian is certainly where land vertebrates became more common, but they had been around in the late Devonian, and land invertebrates had been around since possibly the late Cambrian. Land plants have been around longer still, though it was pretty much exclusively moss-type plants for a good long while.
We're starting to see amphibians.
As predicted by evolution. It stands to reason that if life started in the oceans, then the first animal life to move onto land would have been of a variety that could still live in the water. Same goes for the early terrestrial invertebrates of the late Cambrian. They probably only left the water to mate or evade predators. But in a global flood, would you not expect the creatures that are more comfortable in the water to be some of the last ones to be killed? Wouldn't the chimps who can't swim die before the amphibians and fish?
But curiously, the first evidence that we have of the amphibians isn't the bodies, it's the trackways.
Yes, that is curious, isn't it? Because these trackways are newer than all the rock below them, and you have basically admitted as much in your video. But in order for the footprints to fossilize, they have to be buried in sediment without being destroyed, and then both the material that the footprint is in and the sediment that buried it have to lithify. Lithification can happen fairly quickly, but here I'm talking about geologically quickly. There is no way it would have been able to happen in less than a year. Also, there's the fact that if the land is still exposed at this point in the creationist timeline, rain is now falling at such a heavy rate that it would immediately wash away any footprints that are left in any sort of soft material. If we just use the height of Mount Ararat and assume that Everest was formed during the flood, in order for sea levels to rise to cover Mount Ararat would require about 100 trillion cubic kilometers of water. 1 cubic kilometer of water weighs about a billion metric tons, and there would have been about 2.5 trillion cubic kilometers of water falling on the Earth every day. With the Earth having a surface area of about 510 million square kilometers, that works out to just under 5 billion tons of water per square kilometer every day, 204 million tons per hour, 3.4 million tons per minute. There are 1 million square meters in a square kilometer, so that's 3.4 tons of water dumped on every square meter of the Earth every minute for 40 days straight. Even if we assume that 75% of the water for the flood came from the fountains of the deep, that's still 850 kilograms of water dropped on every square meter of the Earth for 40 days straight. Future Rhino cutting in here, I missed a zero somewhere when I originally ran the math on this. The final numbers that it works out to are actually 340 kilograms of rain per square meter per minute, or 85 kilograms per square meter per minute if only 25% of the water comes from rain. It really says something about how bad your argument is if the rebuttal to that argument can be off by an order of magnitude and still be a good rebuttal once it's corrected. Now, I propose a science experiment for you. Go to the beach and make some footprints in the sand. Then, drop just 850 kilograms of water on those footprints and tell me if they're still there when you're done. If they are, do this again, 850 kilograms of water every minute for 40 days. I can promise you there won't be any footprints when you are done. And this is using very low numbers for the calculation. I could have been mean and gone with the height of Everest, which surely was just about as tall as it is today, about 4,000 years ago. Or I could have assumed that the fountains of the deep only accounted for 25% of the water instead of 75%. And then that's another issue. What exactly are the fountains of the deep? Was there some vast store of water that you guys believe was just hiding out in the mantle of the Earth? Just some water, chilling there with the magma, waiting for God to make some cracks for it to rise through. But just the water, not the magma. How does that work? Anywho, I'm off track. Back to the video!
Mm-hmm. And then we start seeing the amphibians themselves, so it looks like they were running away from something.
Are you serious? You're suggesting that the reason we find the tracks first is because they were running away from rising water levels? Well, given the amount of water that was falling on them, if they survived long enough to run anywhere, I would think it would be to the protection of the underwater habitat, as the rain would have been incredibly painful, and actually the whole calculation kind of ruins the rest of your point as well. Everything on land would have been utterly destroyed by the sheer mass of water falling on it all at once, so all the land creatures would have died first, before the deep sea creatures.
But they get caught and they get buried, and we transition over and we get into the Pennsylvanian, and in this we start seeing the very first reptiles. Again, thinking kind of from the bottom up, what's finally getting buried,
right. We're
getting more and more progressive towards the shore, right? Towards the land environments.
Yeah, except that's not at all what these ecosystems show, and we have deep marine ecosystems from all of these periods, as well as shallow marine. Actually, geologically speaking, we have examples of all the different depositional environments, from dry Aeolian to transitional beaches, alluvial fans, river deltas, and so on, all represented in all of those layers. How do you have an alluvial fan, which is water runoff into a dry basin, in an environment that is exclusively deep sea, like you're claiming the Cambrian was? There are too many environments that are too well represented all throughout the strata, even if we ignore which organisms are found there.
And once we get past this and in through what's called the Permian, the next group after this that continues on would be the Mesozoic, with the Triassic, Jurassic, and Cretaceous, right? The age of dinosaurs. Very terrestrial. There's still marine stuff going on because the waves of the flood are still taking the marine organisms and pushing them onto the continent.
But why are the waves of the flood so selective about which organisms it shoves onto the continent when? And why do we see evidence of dry environments in every single period, every last one? At which point was the whole Earth supposed to have been covered? Is there still dry land at that point? Is this happening on day 36 of getting literal tons of water dumped on all of these animals' heads all day long?
But by this time, you're also flooding so much of the continent that the terrestrial animals are being captured and buried and dragged.
Buried and dragged? More like having their flesh stripped off their bones and blasted away. But again, the marine ecosystems still existed in these time periods, but they looked entirely different from the Cambrian and Silurian. In fact, there was a biodiversification event of marine life during the Mesozoic, known as the Mesozoic Marine Revolution. It was likely caused by the sudden increase in the ability of predators to crack the shells of crustaceans. How exactly does a biodiversification event happen when everything is being killed off quickly?
As we go through this whole thing, and we've got community after community after community after community, right? My evolutionary colleagues look at these as communities over time.
Yes, because that's what they are. They are entire ecosystems that are sometimes right on top of each other in the fossil record, but there has never been any cross-contamination between them, as would be expected if they all existed simultaneously.
For the creationists, though, this isn't communities over time. These are all living at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
They're just not living in the same place.
They're not? Okay, so kindly explain how they ended up right on top of each other in the fossil record then.
And the order that we have in the rock record, from the Great Unconformity on up, shows us a reflection of ecosystems that are being sequentially buried that happen to live at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
But all of the burying would have had to have happened within the first 40 days. That's not enough time for lithification, which means that there wouldn't be distinct layers like there are. But if for some reason layers did form, fossilized organisms would be poking through the layers. And creationists know this, or they wouldn't make such a big deal about the fossil trees that go through multiple layers. But if the flood happened as described, organisms fossilized through multiple layers would be the norm rather than the exception. And never has an animal been found fossilized through multiple layers. It's always trees, which have the unusual ability of remaining upright for sometimes centuries after they have died.
So this diorama is great because it does take that vertical section of rock and it tips it on its side, exactly how a creationist would look at this, as going deep water to shallow water to the land. Mm.
Do I need to say it again? Because that's not what it shows at all. Not even close.
And this, I think, is one of the ways that the creationists can take a look at the fossil record, start making testable hypotheses and predictions about what we should find, and make sense of otherwise what seems to be a fairly curious set of data.
And one of the predictions that creationists generally agree with is that there should exist fossils somewhere that go through multiple layers. But creationists, as of yet, have been unable to provide one single example that is not a tree.
So both paradigms are looking at the same fossil record.
Except one paradigm is cherry-picking its data. Creationists ignore the fact that there are a variety of environments and ecosystems from each of these periods that are very well represented in the fossil record and the geologic record. Also ignoring that one of the shifts that marks the beginning of one of the periods that comes after the vast shallow seas of the Ordovician is the increased depths of the seas of the Silurian. But you, a qualified paleontologist who should already know that, walk past it and pretend like it's representing a trend towards shallower waters.
Yeah.
The data is the same for both of them.
Yeah. And we're trying to interpret those data in the way that we best can and see which one of these paradigms makes the most sense out of the data.
It is, by far, the evolutionary paradigm. Evolution is the one that takes all the data as a whole into account. The creationist might be able to explain a few data points in isolation, but as soon as you look at the bigger picture and connect all the data points, the creationist picture falls apart.
Would humans be found then in that top layer?
Yeah, within the rock record, the only place where human fossils are found are actually at the very, very top of the Cenozoic.
Uh-huh.
Thereby creating a massive issue for creationism, which would have us believe that humans existed this whole time, and yet somehow managed to not leave a single trace of their existence before the very, very tippy-top most recent rock layers.
Now, I have to be honest, from a young Earth creation perspective, my expectation would be that there would be some humans in the flood rocks, because the way I look at things, the Paleozoic are made during the flood, the Mesozoic rocks with the dinosaurs are made during the flood, right? Mm-hmm. Just other ecosystems that are being destroyed. And then the Cenozoic is probably representing the world that reestablishes itself when the flood is over.
So we don't find any humans until what you admit are the post-flood rocks. All of humanity was wiped out in an event that left us a rich and detailed fossil record, and yet somehow the main target of the flood managed to escape being represented anywhere?
So one of the curious things that we find in the Cenozoic is, you know, we've got all of these mammals of different kinds, and early horses, early deer, whales, things like that. And the humans aren't found until the very top. That could be because the humans don't actually go out from the spreading point until much later on.
Well, we do have a pretty decent picture of early human migration, and spoiler alert, it happened all before you think the universe existed.
Now, why they're not found in the flood rocks is a more difficult problem for young Earth creationists. It's one of those data points that doesn't seem to cut our way, at least at first blush.
And this admission is something that kind of makes me lean towards the idea that this guy is at least honest in his belief. He's just really good at motivated reasoning and cognitive dissonance.
Creationists have a variety of different ways in which they might address that. Maybe the human population wasn't very large. Maybe it was concentrated in certain areas that didn't lend themselves to fossilization. Or maybe people, being clever, were able to avoid most of the initial destruction of the flood that built all of this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd stay away from clever as the explanation. It's hard to be clever about avoiding a flood when you're being shot by a fire hose from above every hour of every day. That's it for this one. Today's comment of the day comes to us from RWM, who says, "Vice Rhino, the translation to English past perfect, had formed, in Genesis 2:19, is problematic. The plain translation is simple past, formed. Ancient Hebrew did not have past perfect, as far as I know. That does not necessarily mean that they did not have the concept. Earlier English translations translated the Hebrew verb as formed. It seems the change came after enough people noticed the contradiction with Genesis 1 and became bold enough to speak up about it. So had formed looks like a pious lie. I'm not an expert in biblical Hebrew." Interesting. So, for context, this is with reference to me bringing up Genesis 2:18 as evidence that the story in Genesis 2 is a separate creation myth from the myth in Genesis 1, as it says he will make a helper for Adam, future tense, and then he had formed them. So he said he will, future tense, and then had formed them, past tense, so sometime in between the will and the had is when he made them. Now, I am also not an expert in biblical Hebrew, but I will be speaking to one soon as part of a slightly different project that I'm working on now. I'll be sure to ask him about it, so keep an eye out for that as well. Thanks for watching. Special thanks as always to my patrons, especially Mark McManus, who are the floating forest that produce the coal that is my channel. If you'd like to burn me to destroy the environment, you can support the channel for as little as a dollar per week over at patreon.com/vicerhino. Other ways to support the channel, such as direct donation or my Amazon wishlist, are linked in the description, as well as my social media accounts and my P.O. Box address. See you next time!